Hey friends, welcome back to another episode of the Training Arc podcast.
Hello everyone.
So, how's your week telling you?
It's been really good. I went to my first volleyball training.
Volleyball training?
Yeah, it was a social training.
What's a social training?
It's like everyone can go, you don't have to be in the university. You just have to pay a small amount of fee, like $7. And you can join at whatever level that you're playing at, and you can join the training. So they divide the people into experienced and beginners. And yeah, because I signed up quite late, so I only joined the beginners. There's only spots in the beginner.
Would you think that you would have belonged in the experienced?
No. Yeah. I would want to try in the more experienced one because I think that would be more of a challenge.
Because
I play volleyball for 4 years in primary school.
Yeah, but that was quite a long time
ago. Yeah, it was quite a long time. But I think that, you know, I think I'm okay with that. But turns out in the beginner group, most of the people there had prior experience, and they're already quite good.
Of course.
And so I kind of feel bad for some of the people that, you know, had no experience. And yeah.
Oh, but at least, I mean, was it also the case where they signed up for the beginner's training because the experience was full, or?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. See, exactly. Then, you know.
Yeah.
You can't
so,
really.
Yeah, I had a great time at the training. Everyone was really, really nice.
Yeah.
And
you mentioned that you guys actually played actual games.
Right? No, we didn't.
Oh,
like we played like a demo game.
Drills or?
Like the coach just put the ball into the court. And everyone rotates and nobody serves because we figured that if somebody serves, it's going to be out. And because, you know, there are people that can't serve over the net and like some people don't have enough power just to put the ball over the net.
I think that would be me. But yeah. But you guys had like teams on both sides and at least passing the ball back and forth.
Yes.
Exactly. So that's pretty much like, I mean, if there were no experienced players that signed up to the beginners group, then the actual beginners would be so lost and had no one to play with. So,
yeah.
Like, I think, you know, it is okay.
Yeah.
It would have been pretty fun for them.
One of
the
beginner, which is a girl, and she actually turned out to be really good. Like she learned quite fast and she ended up blocking like an experienced player's spike.
Yeah.
And we was cheering her up. It was like, whoa.
That's so cool. It sounds like everyone was really friendly.
Yeah. Everybody was really friendly. And the coach was quite nice. And he didn't he looked at everyone's postures and made sure everyone was, you know, doing it correctly. And before we approached the actual games and start hitting. And the reason why I actually started playing volleyball is, you know how we made the
I was going to ask what actually inspired you to take up volleyball,
because so there are a few
previously was it in the last episode that we mentioned that you talked about your goal for basketball?
I think so. Yeah, so my goal for basketball is to jump really high, right? And to touch the rim at least. And the rim's about 3.2 meters high. And I figured out why not take that into advantage and, you know, try to do another sport. And the other sports,
like, it makes so much sense.
No, like there are other aspects to it as well. Like I want to join a team sport and I want to join a team sport that doesn't require too much contact. The one that
was it because of your traumatizing experience on the court with a 14-year-old?
It was a 14-year-old kid that traumatized me. And yeah, so not that doesn't live a lot of sports out. So volleyball is one, and the other one I had my mind on is hockey.
Oh really?
Yeah,
in Sydney.
Yeah, hockey. Hockey team. Australian hockey team is actually really great.
Wait, I was thinking ice hockey.
No, not ice hockey.
I was thinking ice hockey and
People just run around.
I'm laughing because Tiaoyu is a terrible skater. He's like very bad with balance. So.
I'm not that bad with balance. I've only skated like 3 or 4 times.
That's pretty bad for having skated for 3 or 4 times.
No. I can I can move forward without falling too much.
I don't think you will be able to play ice hockey.
Of course I'm not going to play ice hockey. No, no way. And so hockey is one, but yeah.
But like, you, the thing was, because I had ice hockey in my head, I thought ice hockey was a very contact sport. Like they smash into each other.
Yeah, but
actual
because
hockey is not?
It was less, because for ice hockey, like, you can't control
the speed.
Really.
Yeah, I feel like for ice hockey, the people go at
violent,
really fast speed. And so when they smash into each other, there's a lot of
power. And like, in American films where they show like ice hockey teams, like, they show a really hot guy, and when they smile, there's no teeth in them. Have you seen those?
Is it because they're wearing the teeth guards?
No, because it's a very contact heavy sport.
Oh,
and they just smash
each
other.
Is that a meme?
Yes, it is a meme.
Yeah, and also, like, what kind of sport, like, is, how do I word this? It's like, why would it be contactless just from looking at the uniform?
Yeah, okay. So, like, I had prior experience with volleyball, and I didn't enjoy it, like, in primary school. But after watching Haikyuu, I, you know, why not?
Yeah, of course. Of course, yeah. It's Haikyuu.
And yeah, so in primary school, I didn't really enjoy volleyball, because we were kind of forced to play volleyball. Like, everyone athletic in the class, you know, run fast, jump high, just, you know, pretty good with sports.
But so your primary school actually had volleyball courts?
Volleyball teams and volleyball courts, yes.
Was that a posh school?
No, we just set up the nets in a basketball court, basically. And that's actually most people do, like what most people do.
I don't remember any of that from my primary school experience.
Oh. Because one of our PE teachers was actually a retired
volleyball coach?
Mu Pai, like a Chinese volleyball team player.
Okay.
From the Chinese female team. And yeah, she just set up the volleyball team.
Wait, so she went from like tier one volleyball player to primary school volleyball coach, PE teacher?
Yeah. Yeah.
That reminds me of something else I heard of this week. I'm going to go into more details a bit later. But basically, like, as PhD students, we can sign up to this science mentor program for HSC science extension kids, and so for students who took the HSC science extension course, and if you didn't know, HSC is the New South Wales high school
examination
system, something like that. And so during the training, one of the more experienced, so previous, one of the previous mentors mentioned like her experience tutoring her student I think last year. And so from that, I learned that not only was the student herself very like smart, dedicated, but also her teacher, so her supervisor for this science extension project, actually had a doctorate degree from the University of Oxford. So again, like, that just reminded me how people in the education system, like, I don't know, like, I don't want to say that I feel like they're overqualified, because I do believe education is very, very important, and, you know, young people, especially kids, should get quality teachers, like quality education from the best teachers. But at the same time, I don't know, I still kind of do feel like they're underqualified in a way. And I
there's
don't know why I have that mindset.
There's actually quite a lot of PhD, like teachers who have PhD working in selective schools, because a lot of students that I tutor have their teachers having a PhD.
Do you think having a PhD helps in secondary education?
It depends on what your PhD is. If it's in the subject field that you're trying to teach, I don't really think it actually helps.
Oh, really?
No. I actually don't think it helps, because, to be honest, like, with a university degree, for example, like a bachelor degree, like, for example, in chemistry or in physics or in math even, you don't need all that knowledge to teach well in high school.
At a high school level.
Yeah, like, at a high school level.
Subject.
Because for high school level kids, they're not really trying to learn all the really the higher, like the higher stuff. It's really to build a good foundation and get them interested in the subject. And the people that do the best explanations are definitely most likely not be the experts.
Oof. Yeah. I feel like I will really want to disagree. Okay. Like, first of all, I think, so if we're still on the topic of the person has a PhD in the subject that he or she is teaching, I think firstly, that means she or he usually has a lot of interest in that area and probably, you know, had a lot of passion for that subject or like for her project. And therefore, I think that comes, that it does feed into good teaching.
No, that's the part that I would actually disagree, because he or she may show the passion for the subject, but he or she may not show the passion for teaching. What I'm saying is that if you have a PhD in terms of teaching or education on how you can improve your teaching quality, I think that's definitely going to be like you're going to be a great teacher because you actually put the time and effort in there.
But I feel like PhD graduates are great learners as well, and they actually know how to...
Great learners are not not equal to great teachers.
But I mean, they would have the skills and like just knowledge on how to teach themselves to be great teachers.
I wouldn't say that if you want to be a good teacher, you need, like you can't really learn how to teach. If you have a passion for teaching, you don't need to learn. You learn along the way. Like if you're really, really passionate, if you really want to put your mind into it, I believe that everybody are great teachers.
Yeah, exactly. Because you believe that it's a skill that can be optimized.
Well, the thing is that they are passionate about the subject. They are not passionate. They are passionate about the subject. They're not really, I mean, they haven't shown anything about passion about teaching.
That is not true. People in academia usually are set up to follow that linear pathway to become educators.
They follow the pathway,
but and I feel like researchers are like education is a part of their job. Communication, bringing that information to people who may be less familiar or even public, just a more public general public audience. Like making knowledge more accessible is a part of their job as well. And
do you think that they're doing a great job at it?
I think some of the work we do, yes. I mean, this is through my personal experience. And so you can't like object me because you haven't done a PhD. But so far what I've seen is like doctors and researchers, so PhD students and, researchers around me, academia people, they are usually very passionate about sharing their research to others. And, you know, because at Melanoma Institute Australia, we are also like very keen to share that information with general public. And we do a lot of, events and seminars, et cetera, to do that. So, yeah, I think they are doing
I'm not that. Saying that they are not willing to share.
And another thing is, sorry, just let me add on a bit more, is that PhD students get a lot of, if they are interested in teaching and education, they can get that experience during their degree. So be tutors, lab demos, or sometimes even lecturers. Through which they can practice the skill. If you say like teaching is a skill that comes along with practice, I think doing a PhD does have some benefits in that as well.
I would say that you don't have to be a great teacher. You don't have to have a PhD to be a great teacher.
Yeah,
and having a PhD will not make you a better teacher.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, the reason why I like what I was saying is that it's not that the science community right now is not willing to share to the public. It's not. It's that the scientific communication side is quite weak, including all the STEM subjects and the healthcare systems.
Do you think that's because there's a kind of like a threshold, like people have to have a bit of foundation before they can?
That's what we say to ourselves. That is actually what we say to ourselves. Really? I mean, that we learn all the knowledge, like we are normal people, like we learn all the scientific knowledge from ground up. Everybody who in Australia most likely to have graduated from high school and have sort of some science backgrounds. I believe that everybody with enough time and with the correct approach and language, they can get the stuff.
But what if they just don't know about it or is not interested in
science? Well, that's what science communicators and educators need you to do.
Or how about, like, if I frame the question in another way, do you think STEM, like communication to the public, is any worse than other subjects?
It's much harder. Therefore, it makes it much, much, much less developed right now.
Much harder compared to
For example, like history or geography or economics, where people can actually see news and the impact that it has directly from their life. And people in science, yes, they use electricity and they use all these different chemicals and they go to the doctors. But
do you think studying the sciences has changed your perspective?
Absolutely, it has. It has.
Like what? Can you give me an example?
Right on top of my head, although it's quite. Like, I didn't realize this until I interacted with other people that does different kind of majors.
Mm.
Like, people who majored in STEM subjects have a different approach to questions. Like, have a different approach to problems.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think that most STEM students have a very... They apply logic straight away, and they try to solve things. They try to find patterns straight away. And they are very willing to try... to do trials and errors, and they are trying to look for patterns. Yeah, I think that is one of the biggest difference.
And what would someone from like an arts background would do for the same problem? What are you suggesting?
What I find, and it's definitely not that like discrimination subjects at all. I find that
and it's only your personal experience.
Yeah, and when I interact with arts people students or any people who does study commerce, they want to go towards people, like they want to talk to people straight away. They want to ask for help straight away.
Mm.
There are more for, okay, I got this problem. Let's get a team together and we can join this as a team. And everyone has different perspectives and different views may give me different sparks instead of, you know, trial and error.
Does that mean they tend to, what's the word,
outsource?
Yeah.
I'll say that they are more willing to listen to other people's experience and opinions. I'm not saying that STEM people are not. I'm just saying that the first initial approach on how to solve a problem, the arts people would be more towards the communication side, and the STEM people will actually, and including engineering as well, they want to solve it through trials and error and from patterns. That's from my experience, at least. Would you agree with that?
I feel like I haven't had a lot of experience with, well, or maybe like I have interacted with people from an arts background, but I just don't know they are from an arts background.
Yeah, okay.
But yeah, like my immediate social circle are definitely all sciencey people. Yeah, so I can relate to one of the points that you mentioned, which was that sciencey people tend to be quite independent problem solvers.
Mm.
And they, you know, try to...
take the baggage themselves and try to solve it.
Yeah, or at least attempt to, try their best. And just quite independent and independent thinkers.
Mm. And actually,
do you think... that's kind of like a survivalist bias in terms of sciencey people being more introverted. So solitude, so like...
I'll say that introverted people are better suited for science. I'm not saying, well, we definitely need like extrovert people for science, and that's willing to tell people what we're doing, right?
Yeah, but I just feel like the traits that you were describing before, like leaning more towards independent thinking rather than outsourcing.
Because that's how we get graded, right? And
right? Yeah.
For art subjects.
Okay.
Right?
That makes so much sense.
Yeah, we are graded by problem solving ourselves within a time control. Yes. And for arts people, they are mainly graded by group projects, assignments, essays.
Mm-hmm,
and they can look for opinions online and for sources online, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's nature versus nature and nurture. So like people who are more introverted are more likely to choose subjects that allow them the independent thinking part. And also, you know, the education strengthens that through giving them a model to follow.
And actually, like, the best experience I had in class was actually with arts people. Like, they are much easier to talk to.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. That's very relatable. Like, in undergrad especially.
Yeah, exactly.
Doing group projects with the science-y introverts.
It's so bloody hard. They don't talk. They're not willing to share. Okay, so, like,
and
we
also,
split the work.
I also feel really bad for, like, the lecturers and tutors because
people
are just not willing to ask questions.
Exactly, and they're
class.
Not willing to ask questions, and they're not willing to expand on points. And when I was doing Japanese or economics, like, in undergrad, everyone was so interactive, and everyone was, like, even if we break into a Zoom breakout room, the science people would just stay silent until someone, you know, break the ice. But the arts people will actually start to turn all the cams straight up and start talking. Hey, what do you think about this? Did you find this hard?
Yeah.
They are
much
more
open.
Well.
Okay. Yeah. So my cousin who is doing a master's degree in design has told me, like, in her undergrad, like, her undergrad experience was completely different, and they always, like, everyone turns their camera on and actually talk. And okay, this actually starts, like, way earlier than undergrad as well, because at the mentor event that I had with the HSC Science Extension students, again, the students are 100% encouraged to turn on their cameras and mics to just ask their questions out loud, but nobody did that. Everyone was camera off and muted and only asked questions, like, via the chat on Zoom or and a lot of them actually asked via direct message as well. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a good thing. That's so interesting, though.
I think we definitely need more extroverted people and arts people to come to the science field.
But then again, like, would you argue that solitude is the, you know, ingredient for creativity and the kind of work that science people need to do? Like, research, for example, gets very lonely. You're supposed to be an individual independent problem solver. And, you know, the art people, if they are put in that setting, would probably suffer a lot, and, you know, they wouldn't want to go in that area in the first place.
Yeah.
So
I mean, that you don't have to be a great communicator from doing an arts degree, right? You can be you can come from a science background, but you're very happy and cheerful. And I'm not saying that some people are really sad. I'm saying that you can be in science, you can be a great problem solver, you can be an independent thinker while you are a great communicator and you are very open.
That's rare.
That is very rare. But there are people out there that have that kind of traits, right?
Not enough.
Well, I think that, this report.
I don't know. Maybe there's a way to change it from high school education.
Yeah, well, you have to flip the whole system now.
Yeah.
All right. How we actually grade science subjects is going to be changed. Like, if you want to select people that have those sort of traits.
Yeah. How was it designed in the first place then? Oh my gosh.
I think it's the most.
That's really interesting, but I have
quickest,
like, no.
It's the quickest and the most efficient way to judge people's understanding is by asking questions and answering questions.
Tests.
Yeah. Mm. Like, I've always had the idea that students should not get graded on their understanding purely by answering questions.
Mm.
I think that a better way to grade students' understanding is to have a chat with them. Like, for example, like, I see a lot of top end companies like hiring people that does that. They ask a bizarre question. It's like, how many gas stations are there in New York? They're not expecting like a correct answer, but they want to see your approach on how you would solve a ridiculous problem. And do you get what I mean? So, for example,
sort of, but
so for
I don't
example,
think that's realistic for.
Of course, it's not realistic. I mean, that if if students can, okay, so like my ideal way to grade a student is by giving them a question. They don't need to do the question right. Just show me your approach and just show me how you would solve it.
Like the feigned abuse.
Well, kind of. It's like I'm not really, I don't want to grade students just by the final results, even if their approach may be right. I don't want to grade students who got the right answer, but their approach was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I want to see the entire understanding instead of the final thing.
Yeah.
How do we get up to this?
I know, right? What did we start with?
We start with my volleyball experience.
Yeah, and but what was the question that led us to start talking about?
Do you think that
we're talking, okay, it was because your primary volleyball coach.
Okay, let me get back to that. So she was super, super strict about training volleyball. And our volleyball was pumped to the max air pressure. It was solid as a rock. And every single student's hand, like the forehand, was bruised. And all the parents standing there were tearing up. And,
oh.
Yeah.
I'm surprised they didn't complain, like those Shanghainese moms.
I think that, I don't want to get into like how wealthy families are. Can change how they raise you, like raise their kids. But what I find is that it's actually opposite to what I think. Like wealthy, I'm not from a poor background. I'm from a primary school that is quite wealthy. And all the parents there tend to just leave the kids to experience pain and suffer a little bit under control, if that makes sense.
Like- Okay, that's a whole nother topic. But I feel like there's a difference in terms of wealthy family and there's a difference even among wealthy families.
Of course, yep.
And like honestly, I feel like a lot of parents don't know what they're doing and either. Like just figuring it out.
Every parent is like his first time parents.
Exactly. Well, yeah. Sometimes, mostly.
Yeah, so it wasn't a very enjoyable volleyball experience. But I built a very solid foundation. So it was too bizarre. Like the whole experience was very painful. It's like we were kids. We were not even tall. Like we were 1.1 meters tall and we have to play on a full adult court and I can't even get myself over the net. So in like in actual matches, the people that can actually get the ball over the net wins the point, basically.
What's the point?
It was, I don't know. I think it's like we only learned how
to... Did you guys get physically punished if you're not doing things right? Or like if you lose a game, do you guys have to do squats or something?
No, we didn't train in any of that aspect. Oh, we were only trained on how to
skills?
Set.
Okay.
How to set. Like our whole entire... strategy to win a game is to set the ball over the net and they will fuck up somehow.
I see. Okay. Well, yeah. That's not very good.
Yeah. So I bought a volleyball a few weeks ago and it wasn't a very good volleyball. It was a very hard ball that was pumped to the max air again. And my wrist was again bruised. And my entire forearm was bruised and was very, very painful to actually hit. So I was actually mentally prepared to go into the volleyball court and have my arm bruised and having the coach spike every kind of ball to me. But the ball that they use were very soft and it's very cushioned and it's not painful at all. And when you actually set the ball, it doesn't hurt your fingers. And I was like, oh, so this is actually the actual volleyball.
Heaven.
Yeah.
I see. Okay. So.
So how was your week?
Oh, I wanted to finish off that part by asking,
okay, sure.
Like, are you going to keep going?
Of course.
Going to be a regular?
So we, regular. So we're recording this on a Saturday. So I go
to. Today is Saturday, the 23rd of October, 2021. Yeah. Wait, yeah.
21. Yeah. So I'm planning to go every Monday social training, like as long as they have it.
Have you signed up to the next one?
Yes, which is Monday. Yeah, on Monday. Yeah, like I signed
tomorrow.
Up.
Did you sign up for beginners?
I signed up for beginners again because experience was all booked out again. Okay. But if I was given a choice, I would actually sign up to the beginners again. Because for experienced people, when I had a look at them, they were doing professional drills and everybody was like spiking and everyone was like setting backwards to it. But the person that handles the ball, like you don't get a lot of time to get actual hit. Like they were mainly practicing drills in terms of like how physical capable are you? And to actually play games, not in terms of trying to improve your ball skills. So if I were given a choice, I would actually join the beginner group again. Mm. It was a generally nice experience.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. So how was your week?
It was interesting. It was both a bit hectic, but at the same time, still quite boring, mundane, chill, because I'm still working from home currently. I had several big kind of events going on this week over the past 2 weeks. One of my major like projects that I was working on for PhD, I said that I would actually finish my manuscript draft by Friday, so yesterday, which I failed to do.
What's a manuscript draft?
Oh, so it's just a draft for paper. So a paper that you submit to a journal, it's called a manuscript.
Okay.
Yeah. So I was supposed to finish that, but I didn't. And so there was a lot of reflections on like why I wasn't able to do what I set out to do.
Reflection with yourself or your supervisor?
With myself.
Okay.
So the thing about PhD is like you set the deadlines.
Mm.
So it's very easy to make them soft deadlines.
Yep.
And very easy to get distracted. Oh well, I actually want to talk about getting distracted, because both my friend and I, have like similar issues as new beginning PhD students. Oh yeah, speaking of that,
we're going off a tangent again. go on.
It's not a tangent. Okay, it's still related to my week. So as I said, I had a number of things going on, and on Wednesday I actually had my first PEM, which stands for Progress Evaluation Meeting, and it's an annual meeting for PhD students just to make sure you're on track. It's like a checkpoint to make sure that you reflect on what you've done, make sure that you're progressing okay, but most importantly it was a chance for you to catch up with your supervisor and more importantly, a panel of unrelated academics who are there to kind of like as an unbiased team to help you discuss any problems that you may have and give you advice on how to solve them.
Are they experts in your field, or are there any other, like just have to be?
Oh no, they are related. They're in areas related to your research. So they understand
what you're talking about.
What you're talking about and what you are doing and what you might need to do. But usually they are not directly related to your project. They actually can't be, because that would be like conflict of interest. Mm. And also like if you knew them personally, that would be, you know, very
biased.
Not as much so much biased, but like, for example, if you knew them as co-supervisors, you would be maybe like not brave enough to speak out about your problems.
Right.
Like this was a chance for the students to tell an unrelated panel of experts what some of the problems that you might be going through.
Okay.
So it could be related to supervisor, like communication with supervisors, or time management, etc. And you can speak, freely. You just speak freely, and you are in like a one-on-one or one or two interview with them. So, yeah.
How was your experience with that?
It was pretty fun. Okay, so before I did the PEM, I was actually quite nervous because the first PEM is where a first year PhD student would pass their probation. And okay,
what's a probation?
So probation is like, so legally, you know, probation is the period that the person gets kind of like watched over, yep. And they have to pass
like a trial
that.
Time. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
But in terms of a PhD candidature, that means from the point that you pass probation, you are officially a PhD candidate as opposed to a PhD student. And there's a couple milestones that you are required to meet in order to pass probation. But actually, you know, in Australia, passing probation is a much more chill process,
yeah,
compared to other countries like the US, UK, or China.
Oh, do people actually get failed for the probation part?
Yeah, they can.
Oh, okay.
And sometimes, so in the US, so as PhD students, you know, you can get scholarships. In Australia, it's called the RTP. I think they have like similar programs in other countries as well. And sometimes in the US, if you don't pass probation, you actually can't get your scholarship.
Oh, okay.
So it is a very important event in other countries.
So it's like a milestone.
It's a huge milestone,
yeah,
in other places. And usually, you know, in other countries, the probation process, like passing probation, also means that you have to do a quite a serious like seminar presentation with sometimes a panel and also your advisors or supervisors to answer the questions and like actually present your proposal, etc. But we don't have to do that here in Australia at UCID. So it's quite chill. I just had to have this conversation with these two very, very, very nice and helpful panelists. And I found the process like just very enjoyable and very helpful.
Was
that
a reflective experience for you?
The whole like entire PM process, yes, it was. Because first of all, in like preparation for the interview, we had to finish gather some documents to show that we have completed our milestones. And some of that could be just like a writing check, some supervisor meetings, some like evidence for you to have like done your coursework, for example, or like done the relevant training. And also it was also a chance to really evaluate your own progress, because, you know, that's what the PEM is for. But that part actually didn't happen so much during the 101 or 102 interview itself. It actually happened before that because you, in order to tick off those milestones between you and your supervisor, you had to produce, you know, some sort of written work to show that you have put some thought into how much you've progressed and how well you're going, etc.
Right.
So yeah, it was reflective, but the actual interview was much, much less intimidating than I anticipated. And my panelists were just super, super nice and gave me really genuine advice about questions I asked.
Was it a question answer based?
Yep, it was.
What sort of question did they ask? Is it really in depth about your project, or is it just a genuine, how you're going, like your progress on how, well, some difficulties that you might think that you will run into, sort of that?
So it's a bit of both. So before going into the interview, the panelists would have already seen your progress evaluation report,
okay,
where you basically summarize together the evidence for milestones that I mentioned before, and also some actual, like, you had to write some points about questions regarding your progress. Like, for example, how have you been impacted by COVID-19? And if so, how? How confident are you in completing on time? And, you know, some comment about that. Was your supervisor supportive through this entire process? Is there anything that you want to say, comment on? And and what have you done like in those past few months, etc. So you had to already write this report up and send it to them before the meeting. So basically they ask questions that are related to your personal report. So if they feel like they need to dig a bit deeper, like you, if you didn't answer, if you didn't say a lot in the report questions, they would ask you to answer it a bit more. Or otherwise, they ask general questions as well. Like one of my first questions was, because I have a supervisory team of... four supervisors. They asked if there were any cases where I had contradictive advice on things that I asked my supervisors for, which I actually didn't consider, but it's because it's quite straightforward to me. The reason why I have four supervisors is because they all specialize on different things, and I kind of integrate all of them into my project. So that's why I just needed advice on each of those individual components or like specialties. So there was, of course, no incidence of any contradictive advice given. But yeah, I can see how that can definitely be a problem for some students. And so it's good that they picked things up, and it made me think a little bit more about that as well. Like, yeah, it just generally made me think a bit about how would I deal with the issue if I ever run into that kind of situation.
How would you deal with the issue if you had, for example, two supervisors having two different opinions?
I would make the call.
Okay, right.
And I think that's the correct thing to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's... Even though I'm quite new to this whole research thing, there were still incidents, like times where I disagreed with my supervisor's advice, or it is pretty common, like because your supervisors, not only do they discuss with you your research ideas, but they also proofread your writing, they make comments on them, and it's just very usual. It's just very common that you're not going to agree with every single one of those comments they make. And so, yeah, the way that I deal with it is have some faith in myself. Like, I am doing this. This is my project.
Yep, you know the best,
this is my baby. Right? If I feel confident, like, first of all, I should put in a lot of effort, of course, to, I should read a lot about this topic. I should put in a lot of effort to study it properly. But when you do that, you naturally also develop this confidence for, okay, I know what I'm talking about. And this, you know, sometimes is also, maybe it's also a case of just miscommunication or misinterpretation. And in that case, I would just be direct, like just communicate anything that I feel like isn't working, or like I don't particularly agree with. If I ever run into a situation where like my supervisors are telling me different things, I would definitely try to gather them up and have a little bit of a meeting with them to discuss the problem. But at the same time, like, or like before going into the meeting or like writing them an email about it, I would take a bit of time to think about the problem, the issue myself, and come up with my own conclusion first and say to them, like, this is what I think. There's a bit of disagreement here. I think we should solve it in ABC ways. And what do you guys suggest? And like, honestly, all of my supervisors are very nice and understanding people anyways, so I don't think we will ever be in a very difficult situation. But I did think a little bit about that because the question came up in the PEM, which was, very good and unexpected.
You have four supervisors, right? I'm assuming that their style of supervising you would be different for all four, would they?
So they have different roles.
Okay.
And they have sort of like different weighting.
You have
of
a main
roles.
One, right?
I have a lead supervisor who does pretty much 90% of the stuff. So again, it's very unlikely that they're going to disagree over stuff because the lead supervisor is the main one who does the work.
Right. Well, good to hear that you had a good experience with PEM.
Yeah, it was amazing. Like, I got some advice on writing as well, which is, so this learning how to write, how to manage time, how to not get distracted has been the like theme of the week.
Okay.
Like instead of doing the writing that I was supposed to do, instead I learned a lot about how to change my approach to this whole thing. And yeah, and I'm at the point where I'm really going to change things from now.
Could you tell us some of the examples that you would change, for example?
So
what are some of the stuff that you think was previously distracting?
Let's talk about distractions first. How do you think people get distracted, or why do you think people get distracted?
Most people will say phones, right?
Yeah. Social media. We're bombarded with information all the time. Mm-hmm.
And we need people procrastinate and have distractions because they don't want to do the stuff that they're doing.
Yeah. Do you relate to that? Because I definitely do.
A little bit, sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So why do you think, what are some reasons you think you procrastinate or just get distracted?
I mean, if I really want to procrastinate something, it's just that the task I'm doing is not really enjoyable doing at the start. Mm-hmm. And it's the starting bit is often very hideous.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all, yeah.
Yeah. So it's usually because, number one, the task that we're supposed to do or we wish we were doing is very boring. Mm. And number two, is very hard. Mm. And we don't know how to start. We don't know how to approach a big, complex problem like that. And so that makes us very prone to get distracted. But at the same time though, this is argument. So for example, it's sort of reflected in the Atomic Habit book by James Clear. So the idea is that you should align your motives with your identity. So for example, if you think that you are a very healthy person, you will just want to work out, want to exercise, and want to eat well, and want to meditate, etc. Building the habit or system to the point that it just really aligns with your individual identity, who you see yourself as. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is this is one approach to solving this problem of doing things and trying to not get extracted and be more productive.
And that's really hard, and sometimes it doesn't
exactly
last long.
Exactly.
Right? You're trying to you're trying to change an overall identity.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And James did mention in his book that this is a very long-term process. Mm. It's not, you can't just wake up tomorrow and be that new person, be that new version of yourself. That's not possible. And this whole, and this approach is just very, there's a lot of, interrogation of yourself almost. You have to look at yourself introspectively and just be very aware of who you are, what are your problems, and become very acceptant of yourself and improve the whole mindset and identity. Mm. And I feel so when I came across this idea before, as much as I agree and respect this whole principle, I find this is such a long winding, this became the boring, hard projects that I don't know how to approach.
Mm.
Can you see this becomes that thing?
Mm.
And therefore, as much as I like to develop healthy habits and change my identity, I never stuck to it. I never made this a good, sustainable routine, basically. Mm. So I came across another approach to solving this problem, and it's much less, much less introspective, and just much more practical and easy to do. And in terms of distraction, I want to quote. So this is a book called Indistractable by this guy called Nir Yale. I'm pretty sure I just pronounced that wrong, but it'll be in the show notes somewhere. But basically, the idea behind this is that, so this guy has done a lot of research in this area, why do humans get distracted and how to not be distracted? And he's come to, one of the conclusions he's come to is that you can basically look at a person's calendar to tell whether or not he or she is prone to distractions. So the idea of that is that when your calendar is empty or have time slots that are empty, you become very prone to distraction because there is nothing to be distracted from. Does that make sense? Like if your time, if on your calendar at from 11 to 12 o'clock, it's just empty, it becomes very easy to just discard what you wish you were doing or what you're supposed to do to like a later time to say, oh, I have time to do this. And just from 11 to 12, just sit on the couch and turn on Netflix.
Okay.
Okay. Because there's nothing to be distracted from. Your calendar is empty.
Okay.
And along with that idea is, again, basically, there's no clarity on how to do that big, scary project that you've been procrastinating from, right? If you don't put it in your calendar, if you don't break it down and you know, make sure you allocate time for it, you just, there's no clarity of how to approach doing that project, basically, in summary.
This was actually mentioned because I think that, I haven't read the book that that you mentioned, but I have read The Atomic Habits back to front quite a lot of times already. And it was actually mentioned in the book also. It was, and James Clear actually made a talk about how you should actually do your calendars. For example, from 11 to 12, like if you want to study French, you don't just write study French. You have to say what you will be doing, where you will be doing it, and what is your description of you completed at the task.
Exactly. And the last part I think is the most important. You have to have some sort of goal that is evaluable, right? You have to, instead of writing down, I will write a instead of writing down, I will write the paper, you need to be very specific about what you do. And to the point that it is super apparent whether or not you've achieved it during that time frame. So, and this approach is much more practical. And I've come across this again in this other book that I started reading out of desperation because I am not writing. I read this book out of desperation for my lack of writing. I started reading this book called How to Write a Lot by Paul J. Sylvia. And it's amazing. I mean, I'm only like 2-3 chapters in, but I just really, really want to recommend this book to anyone who's trying to do research, who's in academia, and also anyone who just want to write a lot and want to write things that they care about. So in summary, like I just want to quote some of the things that he put in the preface because I think it nicely summarizes what the book is about. So How to Write a Lot is about learning how to write out the ideas you're passionate about while still having a life. It isn't about cranking out fluff, dicing big projects into least publishable units, or carving notches into your publication bedpost. Most academics would like to write more than they do now, but they'd rather do it in a low-drama way that doesn't cannibalize their weekends, spring breaks, and family time. This book is for them. And a little bit further down, he also says, this book sees productive writing as a skill people learn. To write more, you needn't adopt a new writing identity, cultivate an authentic scholarly voice, or interrogate your intellectual values. You're welcome to, if that's your scene, but focus on specific behaviors you can do today is faster and more practical. So again, that idea of,
is this book mainly for academia writing, or is it for any people who prefer, who wants to write more or just write a book, or is it just for academia research people?
So it is definitely more catered toward that flavor if you, if you are working on research, because it does go through how to improve some specific strategies for writing journal articles and writing a book, which is required for dissertation of like the arts PhD students. But however, the main principle behind How to Write a Lot, as the title suggests, I think is very applicable to anyone who wants to write more, who wants to, any content creators out there who wants to write blogs about things that they really care about, but just keep using the excuse of, I can't find time to do this.
Yeah.
This is a very, very good book to help you overcome that.
Mm. Talking about, I don't have time to do this. I actually really like a perspective that I heard. It's not really, I don't have time to do this. It's like, I'd rather not to do this with my time, right? Because everybody's time is limited, right? You, for example, from this period of time, you just prefer not to do this task instead of doing the other task, right?
Yep. And the idea that Paul talks about in his book about finding time, like he says that every time someone uses that excuse of I can't find time, it sounds as if those students or academics are a bunch of naturalists looking for the rare species that's about to go extinct on Earth. But actually, that is not the case, because we never fail to find time for work. We never fail to find time for our meetings, for showing up to lab meetings, or for education, for teaching. We never fail to find time for those things. Like Tianyu, do you say that you can't find time for work, for your work at a vaccination center?
No, I don't.
Exactly. But you do say that you can't find time to do things related to Torah education, which is also your work and something that you are actually more passionate about. So why is that the case? It's because the whole principle is wrong. We shouldn't try to find time. The problem is the word find. We shouldn't try to find time. We should just allocate the time to do those things. Block out times in your calendar and just do it. Be very clear about the goal. Like as we said, make it very valuable and very clear that when you've done it, like that's what you've completed. And just allocate time and do it consistently and regularly. Like we never fail to find the time to watch a movie at night with friends and family, right? We never fail to find the time to cook or do whatever fun things that we do in life. It's not about finding time. It's not about finding.
Yep.
And plus, time is going to pass anyways.
Yeah, but there is one thing that I don't think that you addressed is actually how to get started on things, right? And all the stuff that you mentioned, because, for example, like playing games or watching a movie, they're very passive. You don't have to actively put in a lot of brain energy. And you don't have, it's not hardworking, right?
Exactly.
You're laying back, you're passively receiving information, and you don't have to actively input stuff. And almost those kind of stuff, people would not procrastinate because it's easy.
Yep.
All the stuff that's relating to creating outputs and creating content, people would procrastinate most likely because it's hard, right? And it's boring, and sometimes, it's some people just not enjoy doing it.
So why do you think that is the case? Why do you think we prefer to do some things over others?
Because, for example, like the passive stuff is much easier.
It's not about ease.
I think it's about ease because the most stuff.
What I mean is like, what is behind that ease? What makes it easier?
So first of all, is you don't have to input a lot of energy into it, and that's what makes it easy.
Well, I would not flipping your fingers on a keyboard. It takes the same energy whether you're playing a computer game or writing.
It's not. It
depends on what kind of writing and it depends on who you are. But my argument is that what makes it easy is how we feel about the thing. Like our behaviors are not based on logic or ideas. Logic and ideas can influence our decisions, obviously, of course. But ultimately, is our feelings.
Just bear with the dog bark. It's okay. I think he'll be quiet after a few barks, hopefully.
So, logic and ideas can influence our decisions, but ultimately, it's our feelings that determine what we do. If the thing feels good, playing games, eating trash food, it feels good. That's why we do it. It's not ease. The ease is because it feels good. It feels good to the point that we don't feel like we're putting in much effort.
I would actually not agree with that. No.
Why?
Because I think easiness is basically all the passive stuff is easy. All the active stuff where you have to be very engaged in it, it's hard. For example, like most people have trouble with going to the gym because you have to actively go and you have to actually put into effort. And for example, like if you're writing a blog post or if you're writing an essay, you have to actively thinking on how you can construct ideas and how you phrase ideas and how you, you know, get your grades up. And so when you actually study, you have to actively pull your mind and you have to actively try to understand concepts and try to memorize concepts. But for all the passive stuff, you don't have to. You can lay back. Whether you're paying attention or not, the things will still keep going. And it is much, much easier to consume like media stuff because they're all passive.
Makes sense. Okay. Then actually, I think what feels good from those easy things then is the easiness.
Yeah. And for your point, the feeling, I get it. Because for example, like working out and playing volleyball, I enjoy doing that. But some people might not enjoy doing that. But that's also an active side. It's just because I like doing that stuff. That is all.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't have anything to do with passive or active, but in terms of activities in general, not you know, pointing fingers at whether you're enjoying this or not. Just judging by two events, how easy are they? If it's passive, it's definitely going to be easier. If it's active, it's definitely not going to be easier. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, okay. I think so.
Yeah, exactly. Because
it's
just easier. But for example, like passive stuff, it is much, much less efficient. For example, like study techniques.
Exactly. Like basically you gain much less because it's passive.
It's passive. Yeah. You don't have to put into effort.
Yeah. So you don't gain as much.
Yeah, exactly.
And the kind of happiness or enjoyment that you get out of active activities is much more rewarding.
I don't think it matters because if for example, like if you're writing a paper, the reward might not be big, but the long-term reward is there.
No. I'm talking about the rewarding feeling you get when you complete something that's hard, when you complete a hard task.
I don't think that's a thing. No.
What do you mean? The human brain is wired to get a rewarding feeling when you do a hard task.
And so for example, I'll give you an instance. For example, like a student who was a bad student, okay? And what I mean by bad is some student is not performing well academically. And so he worked hard for a month. His grade improved, okay? He enjoys his grade being improved. And after a while, he would just turn back to become a bad student. The rewarding stuff is rewarding for him, but it's definitely not rewarding in terms of a long run. And what was my point? Hold on, let me. What was your saying? Like, what was the previous statement that you said?
I was saying that like finishing a paper is very rewarding.
Okay, right. I say that finishing a paper. Okay, so for that rewarding moment, how long does it last?
As long as my other good feelings last.
Yeah, okay. Would that rewarding feeling influence on your next on your next approach to the next paper? For example, it's like, okay, I got to write another paper. Remember how I was feeling very happy after I finished the first paper? You would not feel that. You would be like, oh, I'm tired. I finished that one paper already. Let me take a rest. Right?
Yeah, that makes sense.
The rewarding feeling will not influence on your next act.
Yeah, my point is not that it influences on the next act.
Okay, right. So that was my point.
It makes sense. Yeah. It makes sense. Yeah. I agree with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not trying to say that it's going to influence your next act.
Okay.
Yep.
Right. Okay.
I was actually trying to say...
when you finish a paper, you feel happy? Is that...
No. I'm lost.
Yeah, just take some time. It's okay.
I don't know why you brought it up.
Huh?
That was so random. I don't know why you brought it up. Where were we before that?
Distractions. We get distracted a lot. Look at our podcast.
Yeah, distraction is because the thing's too hard. So the next time you come around to doing it, you're going to be prone to getting distracted again.
I think what we talk about wasn't distraction.
So changing.
I think what we talk about is procrastination.
We started to lean towards the area of discipline. But at the same time, I also didn't finish talking about the book yet.
Cool. Sure.
Okay, so basically the book is giving you a practical guide of how to approach writing.
Yep.
And it very, very honestly addresses writing is hard and this is like a problem for every academic, basically. And it is actually like very hilarious and fun to read. Mm. So highly recommend to anyone who want this. But at the same time, you know, it also addresses some of the common problems and the stress in academia, such as, quote, and as luck would have it, the standards for writing are higher than ever. Our bosses who hire and promote us expect more publications than before. All institutions from grant-addicted research universities to small liberal arts college, blah, 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 want to raise their scholarly profiles. More scholars are sending more papers to more journals. More scientists are submitting more grant proposals that compete for a shrinking pile of money, etc., etc. And more scholars have been hired to precarious, non-tenure-track positions that, by swamping them with teaching and anxiety over what the future holds, make writing even harder. It's a tough time to start a career in academics. So so close to heart, because previously I also read this report, I think it was by Nature, which was basically a short collection of interviews of postdocs about how they're treated these days in academia. And, you know, it's just super stressful. But so it just also like wants to highlight these problems. And another thing, which I resonated a lot, and it's also relevant to my PEM, was how, like, in the field of academia for any new PhD students, okay, so we value how to do research. So PhD students are taught how to come up with project proposals, like project ideas, or at least. We think that experiments are important because that's how we produce results. So PhD students spend a lot of time training and going through training and induction and courses about that. We think statistics is important, and therefore people take courses to learn statistics and how to code or things like that. However, writing is one of those very underrated skills, right?
Is it underrated? I think it's quite important. Like, people know that.
It's very important, but it's not taught well.
Yeah, okay.
So it's taught through, not through a holistic, like, well-organized systems, but rather by, I guess, what's called apprenticeship, right? Apprenticeship. Is that how you pronounce it?
I'm not sure about other countries, but in Australia, at least. I'm not sure about in the UK or America.
Mm-hmm.
I would assume that they have a better system for teaching writing.
No.
No?
I'm completely lost.
No, in America...
Oh, you mean other countries that have better system for teaching? This also is, as far as I know, American.
Okay, right. Sure, because like in Australia, we didn't really experience teaching us how to write.
We never did that. And it's so important in science.
Yeah.
Like, you complain about STEM students being poor communicators and, well, they can't write. and it took us as long as our lifetimes to get, you know, as bad as writing. Like, it's already very hard for us to gain the amount of writing skill we have, but the amount of competitive pressure out there for academics nowadays is so high, but we are not equipping our students and younger generation researchers with the right skills from get-go, from the starting point.
How do you think we can change that?
Better teaching courses. Better mentoring, better practicing.
How would you teach about writing?
That's why this book is important. You can teach about writing. And the thing is, like, even if you were bad writers to start with, there are so many things that you can do to improve that. I mean, at UCID, they also do hold writing workshops and classes that you can go to, especially for people coming from a non-English background. Mm. But there are like significantly less courses or help targeted for people who like already have a good sort of foundation in writing, like did okay in school, in undergrad, like writing is okay.
Mm.
However, like there's a gap between, I feel like they're not putting enough effort to filling the gap between a intermediate or like student level writing into like, there's nothing to help push us toward being the best.
Excellent writers, right?
Yeah, excellent writers in terms of like academia skills.
Because from what I read on the internet, well, you can't really trust anything on the internet, but from what I read from the internet, if you are doing like an arts degree, you don't have to turn into the lectures.
Mm.
You just have to be a great writer and mm-hmm. you'll be, and then your grades would be really good, basically.
Mm-mm.
And so people know the importance of writing, but I would say that people treat writing and reading as like a chore, right? When was the time where you actually lost interest in reading?
I haven't. Okay. I'm regaining my interest in reading.
Yeah, okay. So when was the time where you lost the interest, where you thought reading was so, so tiring and so...
inefficient?
It's not fun, basically. When was the time that you actually felt that? My time was in high school.
Why? Like, do you want to elaborate? Yeah,
because when I was learning English, I was looking into the library. I was like, when my English is good, I'm going to read all these different type of books because they all have a very great story to actually tell. So when my English actually got better, I was not given the time on to reading.
Time.
I was not given the books that I wanted to read. I was given in class the classics, the boring classics. And all the stuff that I don't enjoy. And we kids treat reading as like a chore.
But did you ever go out there and go back to the library and pick books and try to find books that you enjoy reading?
No.
Exactly. So like, although things that happen to us are not our fault, it is still our responsibility. No.
Because teachers are treating reading as like a chore. That is when reading is stopped being fun. And I don't think that students should, like, we can't force kids to read.
So what did you want then? What would you wish you have gotten instead of?
I would wish that we were given a task to read anything we want for a period of time and write about our experience for reading whatever we want.
What was stopping you from doing that yourself?
So when you read a book for class, you thought, okay, so I've taken the time to read. I'm tired from reading all this. I need a break.
Because
there's a very good YouTube channel called Fisher or something.
We'll find it. It's okay.
Yeah. He talks about his experience with reading as well. He's a current student at Harvard. In IT, and he reads a shit ton. And he actually said that his experience in reading when he was young, it was very, very enjoyable, where his parents would encourage him and his weekend would be spending in like near mm-hmm. the bookshelf and just read whatever.
Yeah.
And it was very, very fun. And he started hate reading when he got into school. And when teachers were giving him books to force him to read about and to write about this book that he wasn't passionate about.
Yeah, I totally get what you mean now by saying like reading and writing we start to take as a chore from school.
Yeah.
But and usually, you know, both of these things are something that people really enjoyed doing when they were young.
Exactly.
When
you were young, I can guarantee you, you enjoy writing a story.
Reading and writing much exactly. more than in my middle years. But okay, maybe, yeah, I agree. Maybe it's a system with the education. But I feel like what is wrong? I still feel like there's nothing wrong with exploring your interest now, with going back into it now.
Okay. When you, right now, you're trying to improve your writing skills, right?
Mm.
Is it out of passion or out of need? It's out of need, right? If you don't really need help with writing, you are not going to actively look for how I can improve my writing. And the fact that you are questioning, like you're phrasing that, how can I improve my writing, is actually pretty weird.
Why?
For example, okay, I take that back. How to be more efficient in writing would be a better sentence.
Yeah, I want to be more consistent.
Yeah.
I want to write more.
Like, I don't really for example, like, you don't really hear people say you should talk more. Oh, you hear that. Like, you don't, let me try to find a better, I can't think of an example. But the whole general gist is, like, how can I write better? It feels kind of weird to me. How you can write more efficiently and how you can phrase your words better. But I really don't like the idea that people are treating writing as like a chore, because they build that from school, like the school system. And I think that writing should be fun. People should enjoy writing. Of course, I hate writing.
Wait, are you saying like I am forcing myself to improve only out of need?
Okay. Yes, I will say that, yes.
And then I completely disagree. Like, I want to improve. Okay, so first of all, yes to the fact that I may be setting these as goals. For example, reading more widely, reading self-help books, writing more, writing more consistently, and hopefully improving my writing. Those are goals that I set in place for myself. Yes, because I want to do better for my PhD. Mm. This feed into my overall like umbrella project.
Mm.
Yes. But why, like, I would not say that, number one, I don't enjoy doing these things as I do them. And number two, I don't see them as chores. And number three, overall, okay, the reason behind me framing these things as my goals, as much as I respect you saying like you shouldn't phrase them as goals, I do set them as goals because I want to be a better researcher. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with acquiring the necessary skills for you to become the person that you want to be?
Okay.
It's like I want to be an entrepreneur. I want to develop my own app, and therefore my goal towards that is to learn coding.
Yeah, I completely agree with I completely agree with you on all sort of on what you said. Okay, because if you want to produce a better writing, you got to improve your writing, right? If you want to be, for example, like a CEO, you got to improve on your speaking, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what my point is, back to my point on, you don't really have to study for arts, but you just have to be a good writer to achieve higher grades. Like by that, I don't really agree with that.
Oh, so you're saying there's something, you're going back to how the system judges student.
Kind of. Yeah.
Okay, I don't think we're talking about the same thing then. We're not talking about the same thing here. I'm saying like we choose our passion project, but of course there are skills that we need to set out to learn, to up level, it's the training arc in order to get there.
Yep.
Right? So and it is not that these things don't bring me joy. And they bring me joy both in terms of the process itself. Like, honestly, reading and writing, as we said, it could be fun. It is fun.
Yeah.
And also in this process, when I see my improvement and when I have achieved my goal of becoming a better researcher, I get so much rewarding feeling, like, and fulfillment and happiness out of that. And it's very valuable. And like,
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Sure. Yeah.
And it is very fun because not only did I gain these skills that I can, like, the process was fun, and I also can apply them in other things if I want. But also, like, the most important thing is, like, my passion project is going forward.
Yeah, okay, so I think we're talking about two different things.
We definitely are, and yeah. I don't know why.
Yeah, so my problem is that we should not make reading and writing that was once fun become like a chore for students.
But honestly, I feel like if it does at some point for you, but, you know, if you want to regain that passion,
yeah,
you still can do
like,
it.
Like, if you listen
and
to...
And actually, it is super common. Like, this is not just something that you and me experience, but everyone experiences. Exactly.
Yeah.
And...
So there's a problem, right?
Is it though? Like,
it is.
Like, those who want to go back to enjoying reading
not
and
enough.
Writing, it's fine.
Not enough people enjoy reading and writing. For example, like, the, like I have heard...
But okay, but that people, also doesn't prevent them from improving those
it,
skills
it doesn't.
Later.
It doesn't prevent them, but it discouraged them. And that's enough of a prevention already. And what I heard that people saying, I want to read more. Do you have some advice? Like, people ask that online. Mm-hmm. And the number one advice is forget the classics. Just read what you enjoy.
Yeah. I've heard.
And I think it's really, I think it's really disappointing.
But there is nothing preventing those people from doing it.
The discouragement
alongside.
From the school, like treating reading and writing as a chore on assignments and that's how you get graded. It's enough of a barrier. The biggest barrier is not your access to books. It's by your passion towards books.
And you think there's something wrong with humans having to go through some sort of development and progress before they realize that they can just go back to it?
No. The development is wrong. Like, reading and writing should not be painful and boring.
Yeah, you sound like, okay, it was made painful and boring by assignments. However... So let me ask you, like, now, after you realize you can still enjoy those activities, are you doing them?
Yes.
As often as you would want, you would like?
No.
Exactly. So, like, I feel like people are ultimately still responsible for their own actions. Like, yes, you get discouraged, but if you don't see past that point, then, you know, too bad.
I'm still trying to find, like, the niche of books that I really enjoy reading.
Yeah, so now there's nothing preventing you. Why haven't you still found that niche yet? Why haven't you? So now after this whole thing has is over being assignments for you, you know, you finish school, you finish undergrad, have you gone back to that library that you were describing, your childhood library?
No, because of COVID.
No, okay, that's analogy, come on.
Sure.
Don't joke like that. Have you gone back to that library and read everything that you said you would read?
I'm discovering new books that I want to read, but I'm having trouble starting to reading them because reading is an ability that you need to develop, right? There are some...
No. Reading is not an ability. As long as you're literate, you have that ability.
No.
It's a skill that you can improve on. You can read better. You can read more. You can get more practice. You can read faster. You can practice on those aspects of reading.
There are some books that are harder to read than others, right?
Are you saying vocab is stopping you?
It's not. It's not. it's so hard to explain. Like, there are some books that are just harder to read.
Okay. Then why can't you just ditch them like you said you should do about the classics?
You can. Yes, you can, of course. I don't know. For me, like, reading right now, if I got to read, unless it's a really exciting book that I really need, for example, Atomic Habits, or something, or like a book that is very easy to read and the story is very appealing to me, like manga, or if everyone is talking about it, I would put into effort into reading.
Okay. You're not seeing the value in books beyond the fun. Or like it's not...
I think that books are mediums just like movies. They should be educate, like, you should not...
Oof. You're going to get roasted for
no,
that.
No. Like, I don't care. Because
there are medium for carrying information.
Yep.
But do you think books bring more value than movies or
no.
TV?
No, absolutely not.
You are so wrong. I'm going to show you an article after this just about that. And
no,
we can talk about it more.
I think that great movies can deliver a much better message than a mediocre book.
But there are more great books than great movies.
You can't say that. You can't say that.
I can.
No, like, you are one of those people right now that's dissing movies over books.
Okay, no, that's not what I'm doing. I'm saying, okay, the if we take the totality of all movies and the totality of books and compare the value
because
that people can get out of them. Exactly.
Books have been longer.
Yeah, why do you think that?
Because it's just paper and pen.
Okay, I feel like it's also, you can think about it the other way. Like, if it's not valuable, if it's not as valuable, and if nowadays we have better mediums to deliver information mm-hmm. and valuable things, then why hasn't book died out? It more and more, like each year, more people still write more books.
Because there are some aspects where you can't deliver with a scene.
Exactly.
You can only deliver with imagination.
Exactly. So the totality of values from books is greater than other
mediums. But I can't say there are greater, like there are many greater books, like there are more greater books than greater movies. I can't say that.
You haven't read enough.
No, I just can't say that. No. Maybe
define a great book. Define
okay.
a great
I haven't
movie.
Read enough for me to mention a
yeah.
book that
yeah,
I
then
find.
What do you mean by great book and great movie?
I don't know.
Do you mean objectively or subjectively? You think this is a good book, or whether it's
the public think is a good book,
or whether it's like many people can find value out of this?
Yeah. Okay. So what I think, for example, like movies, for example, there there are movies that's got like entertainment movies, right? Like you're watching it just for
entertainment books too.
Yeah, like you're watching the movie just for entertainment purposes. And there are some movies that's really, really deep and trying to tell the society at the time or later like a message, right?
Yes. Okay.
And those movies may have you know really have impacted you, right?
Okay.
And those are what I call great movies.
Okay. There's something special about the way that they deliver these messages.
Yep.
I get that. But the thing is,
we're going into a movie versus book debate.
No, this shouldn't be a debate. There's something about, okay, now I hate that I'm a science student and can't explain this better and can't do books justice. But to put it simply, and in my...
I'm not saying movies are better than books. I'm not saying books are better than movies.
I'm saying books deliver greater value than movies.
I'm not saying that. No.
Exactly.
No, I don't agree with that.
Yeah,
no.
yeah. Then we can still talk about
they it. They deliver values via different routes. There is not one greater way to deliver something. It's just a medium.
You can learn more from books.
You can't say that.
I think you can.
No, you can't say that.
There's something about that, like way people construct language. And value is both in terms of...
Okay, so let's put into a perspective. The Great Gatsby, we watched the movie and the book, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which one did you like more? Which one was more powerful for you?
Definitely the book.
Okay, so mine was the movie.
Come on, there's things that you just can't get in the movie that's only in the book. Like, for example, the rhythm in the book.
Okay,
like,
so did you...
Oh my gosh, Great Gatsby is such a good example, actually, because the rhythm from the book, like, as much as they try to show that in the movie, and, you know, you would think, and I admit that they do it, but did you even notice the rhythm in the movie? Come on. Did you even notice? Like, the movie makes it glamorous, and yes, some people get drawn into the rich people's lives, yes, but it is... Like, there's something that the language conveys that is just so magical. Like the book is just down to words. It's just literally...
Did you read the book first or watch the movie first?
I don't remember. This was so long ago. I might have, like, but I know that around the same time, I did reread and rewatch the movie, like, many, many times afterwards and before. So it doesn't matter. Like, I've seen both, okay? And it's just... The power in the language, it's okay, think about it. Oh my gosh. The book is language and
Don't tear up.
Oh my gosh, the book is just language and message like stripped down to its most bare form. Does that make sense? Like it doesn't have anything else. It doesn't have like visible, you know, image. It doesn't have...
Okay, Catherine gets emotional quite easily.
Like it doesn't have the acting, the tone that you know people, the actors bring into it. It doesn't have the scenes that you build like visually. It's just, and in that way, it's so liberating. It's the message is stripped down bare. Like think about how much the author puts into that.
Have you thought about all the efforts that the actors and the directors put into what the book was portraying?
Yes, exactly. And that's why I disagree with it. Like by making that into something that you no longer have to imagine, you strip away that freedom.
Okay, right.
You strip away that freedom of interpretation, and a lot of the things, maybe the messages of the author or messages that individuals can get from the book is changed. It's just not the same.
Okay, it might be that I watched the movie
first. Therefore, the individual value, okay, so the book that the value that comes with the book, like both in the sense that the value that the author is trying to deliver and also the value that each individual get from reading that text, that plain text on the page, it's like completely changed. It's set in frame.
I think it's not a fair example because the movie was based on the book. So there's
that's why it's a fair example.
It's not a fair example. We need to look at
if we're looking at the totality of, you know, all the different of the movies that are created for the sake of movies. Are you saying that? Like the movies that are created for
whatever comes
that can
first
only be delivered
be...
as the art form of movie. No, whatever comes first would not be the thing. Like there is a fundamental difference between having that in text form and having that in a cinematic form.
Like I agree with that. With a movie, there is a kind of a limit on how much you can imagine.
And once you make it something that's perceivable by eye, by sound, by like emotions, no, emotions is also like very perceivable from the book. So like once you just take over the senses of the audience, it feels like cheating.
No, I won't agree with that. Because with movies, so there's
an
aspect.
And also the movie is an interpretation of the
course,
text.
Of course.
And you
well, that's why
that's
I said, like,
thing.
This is not a fair, this is not a fair comparison because the movie is based on the book. It's going from this thick book to a two-hour movie. You can't read Gatsby in 2 hours.
But it's more valuable.
It's not more valuable. It's just portraying a different way. For example, if you have a book that is based on a movie, it would be different, right? I don't think there are many books that are based on movies.
There are none because there's no need to.
Because it's coming from a script.
Huh?
Because it's coming from a script. What I'm saying is that there are a lot of people who look down on movies because they read. And I really don't like
I'm not saying that. I'm not saying we look down on different
forms. No. You're saying that books that like can have the capacity to deliver a more powerful message than movies.
No. It's not about the delivery. Come on, if we compare about the delivery, that's completely different. Delivery, in terms of delivery, these two things are completely different forms.
Yeah.
That I agree with you. But I am saying what my opinion is that books bring greater value to a person's life than movies do.
What do you mean by greater value?
Just greater value, like
what would you consider as a greater value?
Oh, okay. I think what our difference is. I realize. Okay, so you were trying to argue that they are just different forms of delivering the message.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is that there can be so much more than the message that's conveyed through the books, through writing.
Okay, so you think that people have different interpretations of books because
that can affect
that
affects their interpretation of the value. Yes, it's more free. It makes you like imagine things and see the world in different ways, but also the language itself, it's just more beautiful. more aesthetic. Like,
I think it's really also, to a personal...
And you learn more.
I think it's to a personal preference then. Because how do I say this? Shakespeare wasn't a writer. He was more of a the author for the plays. Yeah.
What's your point with this?
So I'm not.
Yeah, we did read Shakespeare's plays.
Okay, so let's talk about what's the thing that the Macbeth. Did you like the book more or the play more?
The play is acting out. That is not a direct comparison.
That is a very good comparison because you like.
How's that now a good comparison? Whereas Gatsby's not.
Because Gatsby doesn't
also
take
saying
all
the same
bits.
Lines.
It's not.
It is.
It's not acting out every single bit of the scenes.
But whatever it was in the book has to be acted out.
No, there are a lot of things
that don't get acted out because they can't. You just can't convey the art in the same way.
They are limited by the time frame. For example, like Macbeth, where the play is shorter, and you can actually act out in like an actual play. Which one did you prefer more, the play or the book?
What's the point? I'm not saying preference, babe. I'm not saying delivery method. I'm not saying which one's more powerful. I'm saying books are more valuable. There's so much more when you read the word and interpret it yourself rather than watching a movie or a video about
it. I think that books are not more valuable.
Then why you read Atomic Habits rather than just be satisfied with video summaries of Atomic Habits?
I believe that if someone who doesn't want to go through all the trouble and make the time to read Atomic Habits, they can as well as read, like watch a YouTube video about
Yeah, then why did you read it?
Because there wasn't at the time. There wasn't a summary video at the time that I read it.
No way.
Really? There wasn't a good one at least. And you can actually make a fact that if you read a summary of a book, for example, like you watch a summary of a book and you're very interested in the book, you want to reread that book. You can actually do that because you want to look into
the point that we're arguing about.
Of course
about,
it's not.
Yeah?
Like the point I'm trying to say is that like the word books are more valuable than movies is quite, I don't agree with that statement. Valuable is such a strong word. You can't judge a value of a
more
medium.
Intellectual value.
I say that books can be more personal than movies because you can interpret, like there are more different ways to interpret a book than a movie. Of course, there are many different ways to interpret a movie, but books, because you have the freedom to interpret the theme or the stuff that the author was talking about, I think just more free and personal. I wouldn't say that's more valuable. I'm not saying that one medium is better than the other, and I'm saying that there are people that prefer movies and there are people that prefer books.
I think books bring more of an intellectual challenge and therefore it's more valuable. The reason why we turn to summary videos or movie forms of a book that you can't be bothered, like a classic that you can't be bothered to read, is because you want the process to be more passive. And a more active process, we get more intellectual value out of it. We at least learn how to interpret the writing, the text that could be very dense to start with if we weren't as good of readers. And it will also give us the ability to learn new vocab, if not anything else.
Okay. Is reading a passive act or an active act?
Active, more active than watching.
Is listening to audiobooks a passive or an active act?
More passive than reading.
Okay. Would you say that listening to audiobooks would be a good substitute for reading books?
Yes.
Okay.
Because the reason why people choose audiobooks as a media is also for its convenience, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So that you can... usually because you can what's the word, side multitask,
okay,
right? Like, and actually there is a really cute suggestion made by people that listening to audiobooks while reading is the best experience because you get the best of both worlds. You get complete focus and the intellectual challenge and you understand things more.
It's like
because
a play, right? That's just like a play, right? Just
But play just is just conversation.
Yeah, okay. I mean, like reading.
Play. If the play is like you listen to it while you also read, like it's like you watch the Macbeth play while you read the.
Like for the
while
Macbeth
you read
play,
the original,
like you know what's coming up.
Huh?
Like for the Macbeth play, you know what's gonna happen.
No. Yeah, because you've read it before, but no, that's different to reading and listening to audiobooks at the same time.
I haven't tried that.
Yeah.
And although I don't agree with reading is more valuable than watching a movie, I believe that reading is more personal than watching a movie. It can be more personal.
It gets more value because it's more active. Like why are you not using the active passive thing here?
Because reading is hard. I agree with that. Reading is harder than watching a movie.
Yeah, would you say movie is more passive and reading is more active?
Of course, absolutely.
Yeah, and we agreed before that the active things, the more difficult things, gives you more value.
I wouldn't say that active things and passive things will give you more value, no. For example, you can be very actively engaged in a movie while being passively watching it.
What the hell does that mean? No. Okay. Like, you don't use your brain as much when you watch a movie. Is that correct? Compared to when you're reading a book.
Yes.
That's it. That's what I'm getting at. That's where the intellectual value comes from. Like, if you're challenged intellectually, there's more value. If you're putting more effort into interpreting those words, and there is no sound and no visual cue to help you interpret it, whereas in movies there is. Like in movies, if there's a word in whatever the actors are saying, if there's a vocab that you don't know, okay, you never make an effort to look that up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't need to, because there are other things that suggest, that gives you an idea of what's generally going on.
That's how most people learn words.
Huh?
That's how most people learn vocabs.
Not new vocab, no.
Okay.
At least not the accurate definition of that new word. Like, you wouldn't pause a movie, look it up, and make it a more intellectually active process and challenging process. Because it is a more passive process. And that's my point about bringing more intellectual value.
Well, my point is that you don't, like, people listening to this, if anyone else is listening, you don't have to be ashamed that you prefer watching a movie over reading a book.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. It's personal choice.
Yeah.
But.
I don't agree with reading will bring you more value. It is definitely more intellectually challenging to read a book.
Therefore, it brings you more value. How can it be more intellectually challenging and bring less value?
I'm not saying it brings less value.
Then why doesn't it bring more value? Okay. Then we can settle that. It brings as much or more value because it's more intellectually challenging. I'm happy to settle that.
Have you watched a movie where you just don't get it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's intellectually challenging movies. Like, a lot of people don't...
Which you wouldn't go out there and watch anyway.
No, people...
People like, just stop watching it.
Half people watch Inception and they don't get it. I think it's a great film.
So, like, yeah?
Yeah, that's an intellectually challenging movie.
So?
And some people prefer that. Some people like, okay, so for example, like...
Okay. I will give you the point for saying that if, because people prefer the movie as a medium to deliver the message, and therefore, overall, because they're more likely to watch more movies, therefore they can gain overall more values out of them. At least they are getting the message instead of completely ignoring it.
Yes.
Okay. But I thought that's not what we are comparing at the start. Okay. If we're saying like, if you choose to get this, okay, a book and a movie, they're delivering the exact same message.
Okay. Sure. Which
and
one of the
if you don't choose based on preference, if you just choose based on I want to get the most intellectual value out of it, it's definitely the book that wins.
If you want to convey a message to the public, which kind of format would you go for?
Doesn't
a movie
matter.
Or a book?
And that's not what I'm saying. That's about convincing, that's about social media. That's what the entire world is trying to get you to do, is trying to trick you. So you can always choose the easier way, the more preferable, the more passive, etc.
The more passive way is not the wrong way.
I'm not saying it's the wrong way.
The more passive way is not the lesser way.
In terms of intellectual challenge, yes, it is a lesser way.
You don't have to, like, you going to reading doesn't have to have the intention of want to be intellectually challenged.
Yeah,
it doesn't. Why can't you just enjoy reading?
You can.
Yes.
You can, but that doesn't mean it adds more value to your life. Books add more value to your life than movies.
No, it doesn't.
It does.
It doesn't.
It does.
Okay. Looking at the numbers of movies that you have watched and number of books that you have watched.
I don't remember anything about the movies.
Really?
Yeah. So for me, okay, see, that's another difference to do with personal preference.
Okay.
So we can't use those as comparisons.
Because for books, I rarely finish a book.
Great. Maybe that's why I shouldn't be talking about this with you. No. Okay, let's stop. Okay. Great conclusion, guys. You heard it, right? Theo doesn't read.
The reason why I don't finish books because they are so... Because you have to read it in a long period of time. You can't.
And you lose your focus.
Yes.
Wow. Like you lose your interest.
Like you lose the interest eventually. For example, I've started reading Sherlock Holmes and dropped Sherlock Holmes over like 6 or 7 times.
Yes. So therefore, the reason that you don't, that you feel you don't get as much value out of those books is not because they don't bring value. It's because you didn't even read it.
They bring a more value for a much longer time.
Huh?
They bring more value for
a
longer time.
For you.
For a much longer time.
For you, because you're a slow reader and you get distracted easily and you can't even finish a book. You said you haven't finished a single book you've read.
No. I didn't say that. I of course I've finished books. But can you actually read a book in like 2 hours of a movie time? For example, can you actually read The Great Gatsby in 2 hours?
We don't compare it like that. Because you get more value out of the longer time anyway.
So you get more out of a book.
But it's not equal. But it's not like you divide the value by the number of hours it takes for you to acquire that knowledge.
Why not?
And it doesn't and compare it that way because it doesn't equal. I will still argue like in an hour of reading versus an hour of movies, you get more out of reading.
No, you don't. For example, like 1 hour of Gatsby, you get
the main... Stop trying to convince me. I'm not going to change
Of course, you're not going to change me either. But we're just exchanging... Like, we are not going to go for like an agreement. Of course not, like on this topic.
But I thought we need to move on.
I think we can call this an episode. Because, okay, so we didn't plan any of this conversation. So, yeah, so it's okay. But what I'm saying is that people don't need to feel they are... less because they prefer watching a movie.
I know.
They can get
You just much... repeated that again.
Yes, because I really want to emphasize that. And people can get as much value out of a movie as a book.
Until you try to read a full book.
But most people aren't going to read a full book.
That's why, oh my gosh, that goes back to your previously saying how reading and writing should be encouraged in school. We got let down by the system because this whole world is trying to promote social media and other mediums of delivering that's more passive and easier to get to you.
In meantime, why can't we enjoy movies?
I'm not saying we can't.
In the meantime, why can't people that doesn't like to read watch movies and get the ideas from them? Because you're going to get... It's much easier to get an audience for movies than, for example, like a reader. it's true. Because it's much easier to watch a movie.
Tianyu, you just previously said it was a flaw in the system that kids are taught to hate reading.
Yeah.
And now you're arguing for that that's okay.
I'm not saying that's okay.
You are saying that's okay because we have ways to make up for that, which is it's still okay because the kids can still watch movies.
I'm not saying that.
They can still get the same message. It's okay. In the same amount of time, they will still get the same amount of intellectual value out of movies and videos. No, that is what you're saying.
I'm not saying that.
You're contradicting yourself.
I'm not contradicting myself.
Then what are you saying? Then why do you think we should encourage kids to read more?
I think it's a valuable skill. With reading more, you'll become a better writer.
So it's just for writing?
It's not just for writing.
Exactly. You gain much more value out of the books after you read them.
No.
If that's not the case, then why? Then it should be okay if we completely disregard reading as a skill.
No, it's not okay with this.
Exactly. Note. Why? Tell me why. Besides learning words and becoming a better writer, why?
For a book, it's much more personal. It is very, very personal. Like, books can be much more personal than movies. You can relate.
What does personal mean?
Like, for example, like the stuff, how do I say this? The stuff that you imagine where letters on a blank page is portraying you, you're imagining it. The image that you imagine is definitely not going to be the same how others are imagining it. Mm-hmm. And that is
and that's a problem with the movies.
And that is a very personal experience, right?
Yeah.
And that's what I'm saying.
And nobody guides or judges that decision you make in terms of what you think. Whereas we are always constantly guided by the things that we are presented at with visual and audio things.
Books are more personal than movies.
And therefore, that's more value. Therefore, it has more value. Because for other things, you can't. You are forced to see the thing the way that others portray it to you, right? Through a movie. Mm-hmm. You are forced to see it that way because that's the only thing that's presented to you. Whereas if that was presented in text, you can imagine it in thousands of different ways. Doesn't that bring us a more diverse like human mind, like a more diverse community?
What if,
like more intellectual value as a group that way?
What if the things that you are trying to interpret in a book is not what the author is intended for?
Why does that matter?
It matters. It matters. For example, that is...
You just said it can be personal, you can imagine whatever you want, and that's the magical thing about having text on the page.
That's... No. Like the stuff that I'm trying to argue against is that... And again, you're saying it's bad to not be able to imagine and just... And not to be able to have... A more
capacity
free.
For imagination. Yeah. Yes,
you're saying that that's bad.
Yes,
but if an author is writing a book for 5 or 6 years and end up being comprehended wrongly by his initial intention,
that's
do you
okay.
think?
What's okay. wrong with that? Why does the author, that's highlighting again that we are all individual intellectual beings. It's like the artist puts out his artwork, right? But the interpretation or what's perceived is by the people looking at it. It's by the audience. And that's okay. What's wrong with that? The audience is not... The author is not the only voice. And they should and he or she shouldn't be the only voice on this topic. So it's okay. It's actually just a very good, beautiful showcase of having a... diverse
really?
Intellectual group of human mind. Yeah, why the author doesn't, okay, that's the thing, babe, like every other human on this planet is just as clueless about life as you and me. So therefore, like, we're just all trying to do things as we go. We're just all trying to survive day by day. Sometimes the author writes a book because maybe they have a message to deliver, they have an advice that they want to share with people. But so what if the people, if the person like gets it in another way or gets something else out of it that's something different from what was initially intended by the author? So what? There shouldn't be a dominating voice on something. The diversity is the good part, is a valuable thing.
I agree with that. Okay, sure. I can go with that.
That's why books are cool.
But I'm not saying books are uncool. I'm saying books are harder to read.
Why do you always have to diss me like that?
I'm not. Okay.
Harder to read, yeah. More active process.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, sure.
More intellectually challenging. Yes. More value. Yes.
The only word that I'm having problem with all those statements is more valuable. Books are definitely more...
So now I have convinced you on several occasions.
Yep, okay.
There is
intellectually
a lot of,
challenging, I agree.
Yeah.
It's
more
active.
Personal.
More active, okay. It
more
is more
personal.
It, like,
more
is what
freedom,
I said.
More freedom, more capacity for imagination.
Sure. All agree.
And it brings more like intellectual diversity for humans.
The problem is
there
valuable.
Is more, the, okay, so if the author delivers a message and it gets received in another way and it brings intellectual challenge to whoever reads the book and it brings intellectual like imaginary diversity among the community that the book creates, right, about around that topic, how is that how is that less valuable? How is that not more valuable than delivering the same topic message through movie form?
Because there are just more people.
Huh?
Because there are just more people.
We're not talking about collective collective audience.
Why not?
Because throughout history, how many people have read a very famous classic book? Definitely more than the amount of people that have seen the same movie. There's a reason why those classics exist, even though you hate them. And plus, it's like measuring it in that way, it's not possible because timeline is a trajectory. We don't know what's going to happen in the future. Maybe somehow that's going to be an amazing movie that changes everybody's life. And maybe in the future, you know, movies are going to be delivered in different ways that also stimulates intellectual challenge. So we can't argue in that perspective. The thing that I'm trying to say is it brings more value in a person's life, personal level value. And that's enough. That's like dividing it by the common denominator is how we should evaluate it.
I still don't agree with that. It's okay. Like I don't agree that books bring more value to people. Books are definitely more intellectually challenging. No, I'm not. I don't want the main aim of a book to be more intellectually challenging. And how do I say?
You don't believe that movies should be intellectually challenging?
No. I think that movies can be equally intellectually challenging. And I don't agree with movies that deliver a less value. That's the only thing.
So I have given you all those things that we summarized as reasons why a book delivers more value to a person's life. And out of all of them, you agree that books are more personal, more intellectually challenging, yep, more active, etc. So there's not one of the category related to value that you propose where movies are greater at. So therefore, we come to the conclusion that books are greater, that books deliver greater value. That's how I see this analytical process. So unless you come up with equal amount of valuable arguments
I'll just talk about how
you're always arguing for how because movies have a bigger audience, yep, it can have more total value.
Yes,
but I'm saying you can't judge it that way because books have greater audience.
No,
as a whole, like if we start to look things as a whole, books have had
audience. If there's a great book and it's trying to, you know.
It's more accessible to people.
It's more accessible to people, yes. Okay, so if there's a great book and it's trying to...
you're trying to say is like people don't get to the end and get the message correctly. But even then, what's wrong with that?
No, it's okay. People can interpret different books.
Yeah.
If there are not that many... Okay, so let's talk about the amount of readers in the world and amount of people that watch movies. There's definitely going to be more people watching movies than reading books.
No.
Why
not? Because movies are less accessible.
But they are easier to consume.
But less accessible.
Okay, I think we're just going around in circles now. But
you're saying in the younger population, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's not what I'm saying. Overall population, definitely books.
Books can, if there's a great book out there, and if there's no one to read it, it doesn't bring any value.
Same as a great movie.
Of course, but people are more...
Therefore, that's why we're only comparing personal value. We're not we shouldn't compare collectively.
I think it's just a personal choice for me. Like some people prefer movies, and some people prefer books. Like some people just enjoy the colors, the music, the actors trying to act out.
So, do you think movies has as much educational value as books?
Definitely.
Then why don't we just deliver everything in movie video form?
Because you can't deliver everything in
movies. Yeah, because books carry more knowledge.
You can't say books carry more knowledge. A textbook carries as much value as a documentary carries.
So why can't we just deliver everything in video form?
If that's what people prefer, people can definitely deliver everything in a video format.
Yeah, and therefore it is okay to disregard reading and writing skills like you said. That was... It's a problem that you said before.
I'm not trying to disregard. I think it's not okay for kids to start hate reading and writing.
Because it's important.
It's important. Oh my God, we're going around in circles. Yes, I'm not saying that.
You're going around in circles because you haven't come up with a single argument where movies truncate books.
I'm not saying one is better than the other. That's what I'm trying to say. And I'm trying to say is that book is not better than movies. And movie is not it's not better than books. It's just two different mediums that people prefer.
Okay.
And some I don't know, some people are not wanting to be intellectually challenged, and that's okay. And they can consume a movie then. That is a completely fine.
Yeah.
It doesn't make them less. It doesn't make them less than being a reader.
Yeah.
And for documentaries and for textbooks, if people can, you know, can get more knowledge from documentaries from reading a boring ass textbook, of course that is okay. And I'm not saying that reading and writing is not important, and people should just disregard that. People and writing is an important skill. If you want to influence people, if you're a good writer, if you're a good reader, you are powerful as hell.
Yeah.
And it's your weapon. And reading and writing should not be treated as like a task or as like a chore in school. That is what I was saying.
But I defined what value means for books, and we agree that books was one over all of them. And therefore, at least in that definition of value, books deliver greater value to a person's life than movies do.
You can't really say that. You can't really say that, no.
Then I think I am willing to be more like out there, like not afraid to put myself out there. And I would actually say readers are better than movie
watchers. Okay, that's okay. That's okay. Yeah. But I don't agree with that. That's okay.
Yeah.
That's why, because some of
and I think that's fine, because you can't really experience it until you fully immerse yourself in both.
Okay. Yeah, sure.
So maybe it's not even valid for us to argue at this point.
Yeah.
Because as you said, you haven't finished a single book.
I have finished books. I've finished Harry Potter's at least.
Yeah, exactly. So you read for entertainment. That's different to reading for value.
Yes. Okay, sure.
Hmm.
I will still argue that it's just a personal preference. Some people prefer movies and some people prefer books. That's all. And it's okay to be either.
And I think, in summary, people who are trying to obtain value would prefer books over movies.
Okay, sure. That's fine. Okay, so this episode was completely off the script. We didn't plan any of this.
Yeah, and I didn't finish talking about the... Well, it's okay, I guess. Mm.
Yeah, so I think this would be a good ending. Would you think so?
Not quite, because we haven't gone through... Okay. Yeah, we can...
We can make this in the next episode. Like, we can talk more about it in the next episode.
Yeah, we kind of have to leave it here now. Yeah.
All right, then. Thank you guys for listening. If anyone is listening to our very long argument about books and movies.
Our very naive and stupid argument.
Yeah.
That probably doesn't add any value to your life.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for listening, guys. See you next week.
Bye.
Bye-bye.